locked, isn't it?
It's right behind me, isn't it?
Am I the only person that's hot?
It's warm too.
I am going to drink the tea.
That's going to be a lot. Okay. Is that going to be too much on you? It's blowing right in.
So I'll edit all this stuff out.
I think it's too cold. We can shut that one open. Another one.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I was pondering that the difference, like when you talked about that, you know, your day. Okay. That the difference would be to be this, you know, part of the world, but to get out of the delusion is that we can be doing all those things, but we don't have the delusion that we really are. That we can really make a difference on, we really can make a difference of the outcome. And that we're not responsible for the outcome, or that we're not, you know.
You don't think we are? Somehow I think. Somehow I think that you're on to something, but that it's more nuanced. That. I think that we do influence things and we can make a difference, but probably a whole lot, in many cases, less than we think.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I think we do. And I think things happen, yeah, because, you know, we are in interaction with everything. And so, yeah, we have impact, but it's that direct.
See, maybe if we relinquish the certitude that we ourselves can make everything work, we'd grasp at it a little bit less and be a little bit softer with it.
Buddhism isn't, I mean, one of the things is that it's always a consequence. There's an action and then there's a consequence.
Right, and that's why I was...
Yeah, so I think that it has to be that what happens, but the thing is maybe a lot of what happens, we don't need to put the same kind of energy into it, and in the sense of thinking that you're the one making all of this stuff happen all the time. Mm-hmm. That it's like, this is what my general plan is, and then I'm going to see what happens. I notice when I kind of go with that, like, okay, here's my kind of general plan for the day, but now I'm semi-retired, so I have a little bit more flexibility about that. And then just let it flow. It seems, it's amazing to me, like timing kind of works out. If I'm doing what I really want to do, like it seems like everything, the timing always kind of flows, and that I'm able to get stuff. I don't know. It's interesting.
Kayla has talked about this when she talks about being on pilgrimage, especially being in India, where you can. When you're on pilgrimage, especially if you're in India, it's like you get into magical time. You get into magical time where if you don't push the river, if you don't try and push the river, things seem to go a lot better. I mean, for me, the example of this, the big wake-up on this, was in the 80s when you went to India, there were no credit cards or anything. Basically, you carry traveler's checks or $100 bills, which you could then sell on the black market. But if you didn't want to carry a big stack of $100 bills, you'd carry traveler's checks, which means you had to go to the bank pretty frequently to get your money changed. And if you were way out in the country, as I was, in the mountains, and you go to the bank, it's not like you go to Bank of America and you hand them a traveler's check and they hand you rupees. Mm-hmm. It was really quite different. You know, first thing is you have to walk down the mountain to get to the bank. And then you went through all kinds of lines and carbon paper and stuff like that. And after about 2 hours, it was lunchtime, and they threw you out, and they said, come back in the middle of the afternoon. And then you'd come back, and there'd be this crowd of people who wanted their rupees, Westerners that is, who wanted their rupees, and everyone was going crazy, and then you'd get your rupees. And so it was an all-day thing, so you went to the bank as infrequently as possible, because then when you finally got the rupees, you had to walk back up the mountain, you know. So it was an adventure. And what I discovered, being, you know, kind of, you know, a typical American who went crazy in the bank, was after I'd been there for a while, I stopped doing that. And I'd walk in, and everyone would be going crazy, and I'd just sort of be very relaxed. And I'd find empty spaces between the crazy people, and I'd get up to the head of the line. And I'd, you know, leave my paperwork off, and I wouldn't be in a hurry, and I'd give him my passport and say hi to the guys there and so on and so forth. And I'd be out before they threw us out because it was lunchtime, and I'd be out sitting in a cafe having a nice lunch when everyone would come frantically along from the bank, like kind of wigged out of their minds. And in the middle of the afternoon, I'd go back, and there'd be this bedlam craziness going on in the bank, and I'd do the same thing. I'd just sort of like, you sort of like slither in between the, you know, the craziness that was going on, and you get your money very quickly, and you sort of slither out. And I remember one Dutch guy looking at me, who was like kind of waving things, looking at me as I walked away with my money, and he was like, what just happened? He was behind me, and there's all this stuff happening, and he's walking out with his rupees. What happened here? That's when I realized that I'd gotten used to life at a different pace in a magical space at a different time.
Yeah. Well, it has, yeah, and it has to do, I think, a lot with slowing down and breaking your routine, too. So, when you do those two things, when you start to slow down, you start to see what's happening in between the moments, and it does feel magical sometimes because you start to see synchronicities and coincidences, and it's like the almost like the essence of life comes forward to help you and take care of you. And that always happens for me in India. I think a lot of it was also slowing down, but it also happens for me when we go on vacation. I'm sure a lot of you have experienced it when you've gone on vacation too, when you step out of your routine. It just gives you, but it just, we don't think we have a routine, but it, so much of our everyday life is routine. Even being semi-retired, there's still these routines that we get into.
Yeah, and that's the programming that we want to kind of.
And I wanted to respond to what you were saying, too, about, because I think that there's so many ways. I experienced this when my previous husband passed away, and people were trying to get me to go on retreat at this Zen center, like step out of my world and go do that. And it was just, I couldn't even comprehend at that point that I could just do that. And, you know, that how would the world get along without me being there controlling everything and running everything and going through my routine and everything, you know? Okay. But that it, yeah, so I think that's, I don't know, I think that's, does that kind of relate to what you're saying?
Yeah, I think so. It is a funny way to hold that. Yes, everything has consequence.
But everything isn't under your control.
But everything isn't under your control. In fact, is anything under your control?
Well, the reason that I used the bank example was intentionally.
Right.
It wasn't anything specifically about Indian banks or life in the third world. It was about the fact that the bank was going to do whatever the bank was going to do, and there was no sense going through all this craziness.
Right.
But on the other hand, the situation presented opportunities for me that I could deal with so I could achieve my objectives while at the same time I understood that it was totally not under my control. I mean, I might not ever even see my passport again, let alone my rupees, you know. So probably I was going to see my passport, but, right, and probably I was going to get the rupees eventually. But, you know, so, but when I stopped worrying about it and I just allowed things to happen, but then I was still very intentional. I mean, I looked for the ways in which things could work.
And that's so true. I mean, I must say to myself so many times a day, don't push the river. You know, rivers are just sort of really like, you know, it's a big icon for me. So it's like, but and every time I realize, oh, I'm trying to push the river here. It's not getting anywhere.
Yeah.
And it's not very enjoyable either.
Yeah.
It's really draining.
Most of us have work that we do that involves other people. And everybody's trying to accomplish their own goals, which might not be quite the same as yours. And there are more of them than there are of you, you know. And you know, so it's going to be some kind of a negotiation. And sometimes, you know, I used to think, well, heck, if I was the president of the universe, I could do all this stuff. Well, guess what? No. He can't get a whole lot of stuff done either. You know, I mean, it's just like, it's very complicated with everybody having different objectives. And
is that like if you're looking at Jung, you would say, you know, or some psychological theories that you were, you're stepping outside of your ego. You're shedding the ego and becoming your true self. You know, when you stop, I mean, in some ways, the ego stops operating as much as your true self.
So you let something else come forward.
Yeah. So it's not like there's nothing there.
No, I don't think that there's nothing there. I definitely don't think there's nothing there. It's just as I was saying, that to talk about the idea of being perfect, when perfection is a matter of shedding, runs contrary to all the ways we think about things. Because we think about perfect as accumulating something and becoming something. I mean, you know, we even meditate on ourselves as images of one form of Buddha or another. So you have this idea that you're becoming, right? So we're going to do a green tara meditation this evening. So you can imagine, I mean, as Westerners, I think we start out by saying, I imagine myself as green tara, I practice myself as being green tara, so I'm going to become a female Buddha. It's like, I'm going to become that, I'm going to accumulate that. And there is very much that idea of accumulating those tendencies and accumulating those habits and accumulating all those qualities. And that is there, but the other thing that's there is you're undoing, because you can't become something you're not, from a Buddhist point of view anyway. What you're really doing is you're revealing what's in there. I mean, this particular problem was talked about by the scholastics in the Middle Ages. They had this argument too. It's like, do you learn anything? Or is it already there and it's just being revealed by the process of study? I don't remember who was on one side. Aquinas was on one side and other people are on various sides. I mean, this question has existed for as long as people have talked about this. So we are accumulating, but we're also getting rid of. And so what does that mean to become perfect? I mean, is it sort of like you're a sculptor and, you know, like maybe Michelangelo looked at the marble and he could see the David in there. And what he did was, I mean, this is a Buddhist idea. What he did was he just removed all the stuff that was in the way and there was the David, right? Well, but on the other hand, he threw some stuff away too. I mean, there's some unfinished sculptures. You know, he thought he saw something in there, I guess. And as it was being revealed, it wasn't there. I don't know. Yeah, boy.
Well, the representation of Tara, for example, offsets or takes us out of or goes beneath the ego, the self, that is, when you talk about perfection, it's very focused on the development of the self as it's constructed by our culture and our training and everything else. And it's not it's only connected outwardly to certain things, whereas Tara is connects us to everything. It sort of remaps us in a connected way. So it is getting rid of, it is letting go of a self that is contained, and we move into something that is representing that which is deeper and opens us. Is that
sounds right to me?
Yeah. Well, we move from the I to the one.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. You move from the sense of mm-hmm. I to the oneness of all everything.
Well, and from the I to the us.
Yeah, and to the mm-hmm. us. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And from hard focus to soft focus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that gives me the opportunity to tell the story I was sharing with you. Jerry, you said hard focus and soft focus. Mm-hmm. I gave the students in my online Buddhism class this kind of exercise. I start every class with it, where they look at some events that happened in Washington a few years ago and then they comment on it. And one of these things has to do with commuters in the subway. violinist Joshua mm-hmm. Bell was playing in the subway, right? And basically everyone just walked by him and ignored him. I think he collected $37. The previous couple nights earlier than that, you know, people were paying $500 a seat to listen to him, but in the subway he managed to get $37. Anyhow, the point is that one of the students wrote back and said, well, everyone in Washington is on the way to work and they're walking with this like narrow focus vision of things, and that's why they're not even noticing anything. So I said something I very rarely ever said. I said, well, why don't you try an experiment? Why don't you just sort of, just for the heck of it, see what happens if you take that focused vision that you're experiencing yourself and just stretch it and begin to open it and open it and open it and begin to feel like that tunnel is opening up and opening up so that you can feel what's happening way out to your right and way out to your left and above you and below you and behind you. And see if you can feel all that stuff at the same time and be aware of all of that at the same time, like a big sphere rather than just a tunnel in front of you. See what that's like. Then the student wrote back and said, it made me feel very small. And I thought, well, that's interesting. It made me feel very small. But what I didn't say was, that's probably the reality. And what was happening before was you were inflated by virtue of the fact that you had such tunnel vision that you thought you were more than you really were. But if you really stop doing that, you find out what your place is and things, which is actually, from one point of view, very small, but from another point of view, immense. Mm-hmm. Because when I do that, I feel like I'm part of everything. I don't feel tiny. I feel like I'm all over the place.
And that kind of brings me to the idea about both are true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we tend to think that it's either one or the other, or perfectionism versus wholeness. But even those things, probably in some way, both are true.
Mm-hmm. I think so. That one of the quotes I got that I didn't read to you came from presumably a Zen master that's quoted by somebody in a book by Jung. And he says, the circle, which usually is wholeness, says the circle represents enlightenment. It symbolizes human perfection. And so he's bringing the two together. Perfection and wholeness in a circle. Perfection and wholeness in a circle. Which Jung says is a symbol of the self.
Yeah. One of the things, the reasons that I brought this up when we were talking the other day was because I was feeling like a, you know, I'm always, you know, when, at one moment I'm focusing on my practice, or a few years, many years, focusing on my practice intently, you know, and then I'm moving on to something else. Then I'm doing my, you know, my Tonka painting, you know, and then I'm doing something else. Then I'm doing the dancing, and I'm feeling like I'm kind of, and David brought up something that I thought was so interesting. I guess it's from Jung again. It had to do with the serial.
That was my idea.
That was your idea. Okay, the serial completion, where you're completing these other, all these different parts of yourself, and then you're moving on and working on another part, moving on, working on another part. But they are, and so that is kind of the path of wholeness, right, rather than taking one of them and just focusing on that, mm-hmm. you know, forever, you know, like taking the Tonka painting and never doing anything else, never taking care of my body, never taking care of, you know, nurturing my creativity, you know, this or that and the other thing. So
I said that because I was thinking that those qualities that you develop are still there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you can kind of go back to them as you move on to the next thing. And it's not like you develop some quality and you sort of throw it out the door and now you can do something else. It's not like, well, let's see, we owned a house in San Francisco, now we're going to sell that, and we own a house in the Grand. We don't own the house in San Francisco anymore. It's more like, no, that experience all comes with you. Mm-hmm. It's still there. You know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can still sit down and paint. You may not paint with the same facility as you did when you've been practicing every day, but the basic skills are there. Mm-hmm.
You know? But that's the concept of wholeness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're moving toward wholeness.
Right.
You integrate what you learn and gain.
To stop worrying about the perfection part.
But I really do think the wholeness comes. I don't think you. Perfection is, I don't know, in that sense. Can you. If you became the greatest Tonka painter ever, would that be perfection?
Well, okay. I don't know if it would be perfection, but I think most of us were brought up by parents who said you need to excel at something. I mean, I was brought up by parents who basically said, I don't care what you do. You have to be really good at it, though. Of course, my parents then no matter what I did, told me I wasn't any good at it. But that's because of the kind of parents I had. But I think for many of us, you know, we had parents who said, you need to excel at something. And in this culture, they're sort of like, you got to be really good at something. You want to keep your job, you better be damn good at it, right? Well, I don't think there's anything wrong with having a high level of skill, but we're programmed. That's what I mean by perfection. We're programmed to be the best at something. So unfortunately, no matter what we take up, that's what ends up happening. I mean, is it okay to go fishing and be a lousy fisherman? Well, why not? Who cares? I mean, do you really want the fish or do you want to enjoy being outside? If you're a lousy fisherman, you still get to enjoy being outside.
There's another piece to it, too, having worked with athletes. They focus, you help them train, they go to the Olympics, they get a medal, and they're famous for a while, they get lots of fans, but you can't be on top of your sport for a very long time.
Sure,
yeah. And I think that's true of all sports.
It's true
this was track
life.
I worked with. But, well, that's what I'm saying. There's duration piece in this, too. So perfection is fleeting.
Yes.
And it's a great high to watch these people and what happens to them and how they don't want friends, they want fans. And it reconfigures relationships with other people that do not lead to wholeness, and very few are able to get it together. Some do, but there's quite a down when
So do you think that wholeness is not fleeting, or at least less fleeting in the way you're talking about it?
Well, I don't think wholeness is fleeting. To me, it's a process of growth that continues to expand and flower, whereas the perfection in terms of how we define it in our culture, it leads to a lot of emptiness, a lot of sadness, a lot of unhappiness, and because it leads, it's very
it's
isolating.
It's
isolating to train. It's isolating afterwards.
And the moment, I mean, it's like every moment is perfect, or only some moments are perfect. Or you are perfect, or you're not perfect.
Or just are, you know?
You know, I think also those, the things that we talk about, like, you know, the distinctions between, like, spiritual practice and dance and tanka painting and so forth, it's all spiritual practice, right? You know, and it's all, like, I'm just repeating.
Yeah, no, and that's been my issue, is in trying to sort through that, this figure. Because that's what the way it seems to me.
That's because our culture says they are distinct.
Yeah, and it's partially because of the intense training that I had in, you know, like Buddhism and Tantra and stuff like that in the beginning. It was very monastic-oriented, retreat-oriented, long retreats, you know, a lot of stuff like that. So when you do a lot of that, you get in this mindset that if you're not doing that, that something's wrong, right? And so that's what I'm dealing with. But at the same time, I'm understanding that I need to be, that my practice right now, my main practice is dancing so that my body heals, you know? And I think, but the other's not, like David said, you don't reject the other part, though. You know, and that's my tendency, is I can tend to kind of leap from thing to thing and kind of semi-reject some of this, you know, what came before. But it's still there. Like you said, it's not gone.
You want to have the last word, Deb?
Well, I think what I hear and what I have learned in my short practice of Buddhism is perception. I have, like, this hammering word that keeps coming to me. Perception. All of these things, I mean, when we're born, we start learning and things start coming to us. And it's how we perceive things, whether it's ourself or the world or our job or our friends. Whatever the responsibilities are, I think what I've learned is just to make sure my perception is correct, which I think is really difficult sometimes. But it's easier when you have what might be a better perception than just letting something else control. But yeah, all of these things on some level are your perception of things. And so I think if I can keep that in line, for me, my practicing of this is much more real. And that's what I think I get the most of, is making sure that all of these things are perceived to the best of my ability.
Snack time. 10 minutes.
Okay, yeah. Is that what time is it?
Well, it's 7:49.
Yeah, so we'll do about 10 minutes, and then we'll come back and do a half an hour of guided meditation tonight, not the reading of the sadhana, since we have a lot of new people here. But we will do a guided meditation. Yeah, I'll do it. I'll do the work.
It's part of your perfection. But you can do it. You're one of the only